Radio.
Choosing Life, a talk by Archbishop Anthony Fisher and Sister Miriam Caritas SV at the Australian Catholic Youth Festival 2015, held at the Adelaide Convention Centre.
Welcome all to this workshop. I'm doing it jointly with Sister Miriam, who's one of the Sisters of Life, come out to us from New York, and she'll talk a bit about their apostolate and some of the practical things we can do about building a culture of life and celebrating life. What I'd like to do with you today is talk a bit about what are the big questions right now and on the horizon for us in the area of bioethics, in the area of life, death, health, healthcare, and then give you some thoughts on where would you go to get any answers, any wisdom on these things? What are some of the tools we might use to think these things through? What are some of the answers we might give to people that want to know what we think and when we're trying to work out for ourselves what we think? So that's my plan. There'll be a little video clip along the way to give me a breather. Then I'll hand over to Sister Miriam and she'll give you some example of people who are really practically on the ground trying to build a culture of life and do things to make for a world that loves and celebrates, supports life. Okay. New ways of making babies. I'm going to look at new ways of making babies, new ways of unmaking babies, issues at the end of life and issues in between. So we're at the start of life. At least 5 million people walking around the world today were made in laboratories. And to achieve those IVF successes, at least 50 million, probably 100 million human embryos died in the process. These technologies are very expensive, not just in dollars, but in early human lives. But it means we now have the ability to commission people to provide the eggs, the sperm, or the embryo made from eggs and sperm. Someone else might be paid to carry the baby, to be the surrogate mother. Another couple again will be the ones that will bring up the baby. And then they're the lab parents, the people who actually bring it all about, bring about the conception. And so these 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different people may or may not be related to each other. They might do it altruistically or they might do it for money. They might be alive or they might even be dead. We can take sperm now from dead men if you get to it quickly enough. You can take eggs from aborted baby girls and mature those eggs to use for IVF. You can use a comatose woman who's nearly dead to carry babies. We've even tried in Australia to put human embryos into sheep to see if we can get sheep to carry human babies. So there's lots of possibilities now that we've broken the nexus between life and love, between marriage and family, between making love and making babies. On the near horizon, there are all sorts of other possibilities. Clearly, there's people that want to make sure these technologies are available for gay couples to have families. There's a whole IVF industry trying to look at new markets, new ways of promoting the use of these technologies, designer babies, cloning, all sorts of possibilities, animal-human hybrids, male mothering, and so on. And the industry wants to break down any lingering taboos, any lingering worries we have about any of this. So that the notion that people have a right to a child is gradually taking over from the previous idea that children are a gift or a trust. The notion that the rights of adults come first is gradually taking over from the previous idea that the interests of the child must be paramount. So that we're getting a kind of market way of thinking that says, if you've got the money and you've got the technology, you can have the kid, whatever way it's made, for the adult who's got everything. You've got the car, you've got the house, you've got the devices, you've had all the experiences, now you want the designer kid as well. And in an age when adults expect to get what they want, at least if they can pay for it, in the model and colour they want, children are becoming the last consumer good for the adult who has everything. And that challenges us, it challenges your generation. But how are we going to think about reproduction, procreation? How do we think about family, about the relationships between adults and children, and so much more? New ways of making babies, there's also new ways of unmaking babies. 80,000 plus children are aborted in Australia every year. Maybe one in four Aussie women has an abortion at some stage in her lifetime. So we all know and love someone who's had an abortion, whether we realise it or not. It's that common amongst women in Australia. It's in fact the most common surgical procedure in the world today. And meanwhile, there's a whole new range of drugs that have come on the market or are soon to come on the market. Emergency contraceptives, RU486, various ways of doing abortion chemically rather than surgically. People are very invested in this industry, often because they've been through it themselves or someone they love has been through it. But it does have many downsides. We know, for instance, that huge numbers of early human lives die by abortion. That's obvious. But also lots of women are left wounded in one way or another from the abortion epidemic. Women who are left physically damaged, for instance, who have trouble conceiving when they want a child later, or psychologically damaged, traumatised, spiritually damaged. Women who just are grieving, often for a very long time and unexpected times, and there's no one to talk to. They feel it's a subject they can't talk about. They're ashamed, they're hurt. Men too can be damaged by going through this experience or having their wife or girlfriend go through this experience. Couples in Australia who are infertile now find it pretty well impossible to adopt. There are pretty well no babies for adoption in Australia now. Some go overseas looking to adopt a child. But the days when there were orphanages, when it was possible for people to adopt children in Australia, are over. Because these children don't see the light of day. They are aborted before they're born. And you could point to lots of other effects, the rapid ageing of this country, lots of other effects from the big abortion numbers, the not just the making of babies, but the unmaking of babies that goes on in our country. And one that's on the horizon has already started to touch us in Australia is the new genetics. The new genetics means we can test the human genome, the genes in our human cells, and find out all sorts of things about people. And there's enormous therapeutic potential in that for the future. But the main way for now that that science will be used and is used is to test unborn babies to see if they've got things we don't want them to have. 19 out of 20 Downs babies are killed in Australia before they're born. And more tests are available. So parents will be able to test, is my kid going to be an asthmatic? Is my kid going to have a higher than normal chance of getting cancer later in life? Or a heart attack? Or have the wrong eye colour? Or not be as big and athletic as I'd like? Or not be as small, nerdy and intelligent as I'd like? Or whatever it is they want in their kid. You'll be able to test for a lot of those things. Indeed, we can already test for a lot of those things and abort if the child isn't what you want. You can already get tests in America, for instance, for predisposition to obesity. So is my child going to be fat? And if so, I can abort. Start again. There are going to be more and more of those decisions. And parents will be in a position of being basically technologically driven to not bond to your child until you're sure the child fulfills your specifications, till you've had all the tests and decided whether to go ahead or abort. After new ways of making and unmaking babies, then there's midlife. There's our life, your stage of life. And medical advances now allow people to live longer and healthier and more comfortable lives, to be cured of various illnesses and symptoms, to have suffering alleviated. There's so much good we can do through healthcare today. So much that is a very great benefit. But it always comes with new conundrums, new dilemmas for us, morally, financially, medically, whatever. For instance, how do we think of our bodies today in the world of modern medicine? And how do we think of our minds in the world of modern medicine? At a time now when we can remake our bodies surgically, chemically, hormonally, where people can decide, like Michael Jackson did, I don't like that I have African features, so I'm going to get my skin bleached and my jaw remade. Cindy Jackson here, London woman, she decided to have all those operations, if you can read them. It's a lot of operations. It was hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on her so she could be remade as the Barbie doll. That's the model she gave the doctors and said, I want to look like that. Remake me. That included peeling off her chin and sawing some of it away, some really dramatic operations to remake herself. And people today can say, well, I don't like being a man, I want to be a woman. So you can have yourself remade to look like a woman, or vice versa. Or maybe you'll do one and then the other and then a third. We can remake our look, our body, with medical science. We can also remake our mind. There's all sorts of party drugs, performance-enhancing drugs, a whole new generation of drugs that are going to affect our imagination, our memory, our intelligence. Drugs and other interventions to make us more aggressive or less aggressive, more shy, more out there. All sorts of possibilities with the use of pharmacology and other techniques. We know lots of kids are drugged today because they're too troublesome in class. Drug them. Lots of old people are drugged today because they go wandering. It's easier to look after them if you keep them chemically tied up. We're going to have more and more of those possibilities into the future. With organ transplantation too, we can do all sorts of things now to keep people alive longer, and most of those are really positive things. But you've still got lots of questions, like who gets the organs when there aren't enough for everybody? How do you decide? Or is it always moral the way we get the organs? The smallest organ for transplant is called a stem cell, a tiny cell. And these are special cells, we've all got them in our bodies, which can repair other cells and replace other cells that are damaged. They're really helpful then when there's something wrong. As I say, we've all got them. We can get them from each other. Bone marrow transplants are exactly examples of that. But one place people are interested in getting these cells from is human embryos, because when they're very little, very young, they're very good at growing very quickly in lots of different ways. And so one of the ways we're going to transplant organs is by killing human embryos to get these cells that we want from them to use for adults. Well, there's some big ethical questions there. What's to be our attitude to our bodies, to our minds, to manipulating those things? What about very weak people, the unborn ones, the embryos and the like? What's our attitude to them? Do we just cannibalise them for parts? Do we treat them as moral equals? How are we to think through some of those issues? And finally, there's the other end of life. Developments like transplants, xenotransplants, that's using animal organs, artificial organs, genetic engineering, might increase the human lifespan by 20 to 40 years in the century ahead. At least for those who've got the money and live in affluent countries. Question is, or how long should we extend human life or prolong human dying? When should we feed artificially, for instance? How do we distribute resources? How do we care well for elderly people and for dying people? And that's very challenging in a world that is inclined to warehouse the elderly in some institution far away where we don't have to look at them anymore. A world that's, we don't see death and we don't want to see death. It doesn't happen at home anymore. It happens away in some institution. It's thoroughly technologized. How are we to think of being old and dying and dead? And of course, one big temptation in this culture right now is to try and tame death by euthanasia, by deciding ourselves when people will die, whether we ourselves or the elderly and handicapped when they can't decide for themselves. So I'd like to show you a little video clip on that matter to give me a little bit of a rest from talking, and then I'll be back for a little while. So apart from giving me a bit of light relief from my talk, I thought that might interest you just as with some thoughts of how would you approach an issue like this with your friends, with a debate, with people that want to know if you have a pro-life sympathy, how do you answer the sort of questions? And that's one person's attempt to answer some of the questions that I think are on a lot of people's minds. I'd like to finish my presentation with a few thoughts for you on, well, how do we think through all these conundrums that your generation is facing or is going to face in the next few years at the making and unmaking of baby stage, at the middle of life stage or at the end of life stage, because they're there at every stage of life now for us. Okay. Well, one way to approach these things is purely philosophically, so not introducing any questions of faith, but in a way that means you can talk with people who don't share your faith, who come from an entirely secular viewpoint. You look at, well, what are the codes of ethics, the Hippocratic tradition that we have inherited in our culture, the Hippocratic oath and tradition of medicine and nursing, or various secular philosophical traditions that offer us a code of ethics. And that's the ancient one I've put up there from now 2,300 years ago, roughly. Or you can go right through to the Declaration of Geneva, which is the modern version of that for health professionals that was produced after the Second World War. And the big idea in the Hippocratic Oath and that tradition is a pretty simple one, but very important one. that the goal of healthcare is to save, heal, and care. Always save, heal, and care. Never kill, harm, or abandon. Never kill, harm, or abandon. And that's the Hippocratic tradition. That's why the Hippocratic Oath, for instance, says no to abortion, says no to euthanasia. Because those are not things that are saving life, they're actually killing life. They're not things that are healing the body, they're actually damaging the body. They're not things that are caring for people, they're actually making sure the people are gone, they're abandoned. So the Hippocratic tradition is one way into this. Look at the codes of medical ethics, look at good philosophies, good philosophical treatments of ethics and what they say. Of course, for us Christians, another place we'd naturally go to look is the Bible. And it has a lot of wisdom to offer on these questions. These are not just questions for our generation. They hadn't heard about cloning back in those days. But questions like how do we regard human life, our own bodies, our relationships to each other, these have been questions for every human being throughout history. And so the Bible has a lot of wisdom to offer about these life and death, health and healthcare issues. And it has a very strong theme through the Bible, thou shalt not kill, that we don't kill innocent people, that we don't deliberately damage each other, that we don't abandon each other, we have to care for the weak. Those are very important themes from the Old Testament onwards, right through the New Testament and right through the Christian tradition to today. The New Testament adds all the stories about Jesus as a healer. Jesus being the one that people came to when they were in pain or sickness to receive relief, to be made whole again. And Christians ever since have carried on that mission of trying to be healers, trying to care for people when they are weak or when they're damaged. And in fact, we have built up the biggest and oldest healthcare in the network in the world. The Catholic healthcare system around the world is much bigger than that of the United Nations or of the US government or of any other organization on this earth. As I said in that interview, we walk our talk when we talk about caring for the suffering. We actually do it, and we do it big time through hospitals and clinics and orphanages, nursing homes. You think of all the different ways that our church cares for the sick and the suffering. Inspiring a lot of that is, of course, the wonderful story of the Good Samaritan, of the person that intervened when they saw someone beaten up and left for dead, intervened to give them basic nursing care. You remember he poured wine and oil. We're not told where he poured them. Maybe he poured the wine in here, so it was a kind of anesthetic, and poured the oil on the wound, so it was a kind of antiseptic. And then what did he do? He put him on his horse and took him to an inn where presumably you could get more wine to pour in here and get him bandaged up and kept warm and looked after. Pretty basic nursing care. Well, that the inspiration of that has been behind that huge network that we Christians have built up to care for people down through the centuries. Another place we might go if we're looking for some wisdom on these topics is the Catechism. I hope you've all heard of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It's a great guidebook to all sorts of questions, but it's also useful if you're wanting to follow up an angle, because often there'll be footnotes that'll tell you, like, abortion might have just one very short paragraph, but then there'll be a footnote that'll tell you the name of one, two, three other church documents, which if you want to Google those, you can find those to read more if you want to know more. So it's very useful in that way as well, as a way into what do Catholics think about these things, because there's lots of good documents out there from the church about how to think about these things. What do they say? And this is the whole of Catholic bioethics in 3 minutes. I usually give a course for 12 or 24 weeks on this with 2 or 3 hours per week, but you'll get it in 3 minutes. Life is always a great and good of inestimable value. Every human being's life matters. No matter how bad their condition, nothing can lessen the intrinsic dignity of every human being. They all deserve our love and reverence and respect. And no personal benefit to someone else or social benefit can justify destroying innocent human lives. God is the Lord of life and commands our reverence and love for every human person. And so it's because of that attitude, that very positive attitude to human beings and to human life, that we have limits, we have boundaries. There are things we just won't do as Christians. We're not going to go killing innocent people randomly in shopping malls or at schools, like seems to be a bit of a sport at the moment in some parts of the world. We're not going to make a political point as terrorists by just picking innocent groups of people in sports stadiums or at cafes and killing them to make our point. We can't do that because human beings matter too much. And we're not going to do things then like direct killing, like abortion, abortion drugs, experimenting lethally on embryos, search and destroy for people who have got genetic things we don't want, killing handicapped babies, committing suicide or assisting suicide or euthanasia. And indeed, our Catholic tradition too is also very critical of most of what goes by the name of capital punishment and war. Those things could only ever be justified, our Catholic tradition says, as genuine self-defence, as really trying to defend life, never as wanting to kill people because you don't like them. Now, there's lots of ifs and buts and difficult areas that come up immediately from this. How do we get to people's real intentions? What if their motives are merciful? Sometimes a thing looks like euthanasia, but actually all it is, as in the interview today, is just giving people appropriate pain relief or taking away treatments that are too burdensome for them. That's not euthanasia. But outsiders looking in might think it is. We do have to do some hard thinking. We do need to be formed well in the ethics of this area, especially if we're going to be health professionals. But in fact, all of us are going to be patients at some stage. All of us are going to love someone else who's a patient, and we might have to make decisions for them or with them. So we all need that kind of formation. We all need to have thought through some of these issues. And so there are lots of things to think through, and that's why the church has got those great documents out there, like John Paul's one called The Gospel of Life, to help us think through these important areas of life. Apart from life and death issues, there's also issues about how we care for people. This is a painting of a leg transplant done by some early saints of the church before they'd invented transplants. But the thought here is we should look after our own health as much as possible. When we can't, we get help from others to look after our health. We live healthy lifestyles. We get healthcare when we need it. And what healthcare is about therapy. It's about fixing us when there's a problem. It's not about redesigning us. It's not about somebody who you go in, you've got an appendix operation. You don't want the doctor to look at you and say, well, I think she needs a nose job as well. I don't like the look of her face. You hope to come out of the surgery, nothing done to you you didn't ask for and didn't need. And why do we trust doctors when we're so vulnerable? It's because we trust them to follow that kind of ethic that I've talked about, the save, heal and care ethic. You wouldn't let yourself be put under general anaesthetic if you thought that these guys are just going to experiment on you, might decide that they're going to kill you, depends on their mood or on their ideology. We trust them to have very high ethics, or else we'd never dare go near a hospital. We certainly would never let general anaesthesia happen to us. And so then there are things, I've listed things we do, there are things then we don't do. We don't take inappropriate risks with our bodies, with our health. We look after ourselves. We don't go doing things like trading in organs, killing very early human lives to use their parts, and so on. And so if I might just conclude there with two little thoughts. This is from Pope John Paul, St. John Paul, in his wonderful encyclical called The Gospel of Life. And it's a call to our generation. He says, be the people of life and for life, that together we may offer this world of ours new signs of hope and work to ensure that justice and solidarity will increase and that a new culture of human life will be affirmed for the building up of an authentic civilization of truth and love. That's a wonderful goal he gave the 21st century. And one of the I think, purest, clearest examples of a response to that call is the Sisters of Life, who I'll be inviting to speak to us next. But one last quote to leave you with. This is from a great friend of mine, Pier Giorgio Frassati. To live without faith, without a patrimony to defend, without a steady struggle for truth, that's not living, just existing. We must never just exist. We must live. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Grace. That was beautiful. It is such a great joy to be with you. As His Grace mentioned, my name is Sister Miriam. I'm with the Sisters of Life from New York. And like the Dominicans, the Archbishop's community, we take the traditional vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. But we as Sisters of Life take a special fourth vow to protect and enhance the sacredness of human life. We've really been entrusted in the church with a privileged mission to protect and enhance the beauty and dignity of the human person, to proclaim really that all human life is sacred, that you are sacred. We serve women who find themselves pregnant and in crisis, often pressured or tempted to abortion. We have a convent in the heart of New York City, Sacred Heart of Jesus, where some of these women, if they need a place to live, will actually live with our sisters during their pregnancy and then for a time afterwards. We host all sorts of weekend retreats where we see again and again that Christ offers new life and hope to those who seek him. And we also have a ministry of accompaniment to those who suffered after an abortion experience. The women who come to us are some of the most heroic witnesses of God's love and mercy that I've ever met. For about 5 years, I was living at one of our convents, which is located in the Bronx. And if you're not familiar with New York, the Bronx is one of the five boroughs that makes up New York City. And the Bronx, it's full of character. And the convent is next door to the parish school. And so every so often, we're invited to come and join the kids during the school day. And what we love the most are the conversations we have over lunch. And one particular day, we were having lunch with a couple of 5 and 6 year olds, the little ones. And there was one little 5 year old who couldn't stop staring at our veil. And at one point she couldn't help herself and just blurted out, "What's that thing on your head?" And so one of the sisters started talking about brides and weddings, right? And then she said to her, "You know, well, as a sister, well, I wear a veil because I'm married to Jesus." And this little 5 year old girl threw her hands down on the table and said, "He chose you?" She's right. It can be hard to believe. Believe me, I'm asking myself that very question every day, you know. But I think more than anything, she was surprised that Jesus chooses anyone and that he had somehow communicated his choice to that particular sister. This little girl, even at the age of 5, knew the significance of being chosen, right? Being loved in a particular way. We all long to be chosen, picked out, and seen as special. This is what Christ longs to fulfill in each of us. Scripture tells us God chose us in his Son. God chose you to exist. You are loved into existence by God, who is our origin and our destiny. He never wants us to be separated from him. Scripture goes on to say that not only were we chosen by God, but he did so before the creation of the world. Creation, it's not an event of the past, right? But it happened to you and to me. There was a time when you did not exist, and then snap, God breathed life into your soul, and you were destined to live forever. At the moment of your creation, God impressed upon your soul his love. It was like a divine kiss, I like to think of it. And you go through life with this experience of a love that's infinite. This is why our desires continue to be unsatisfied by the things of this world, even the best things of this world. Jesus is the Word of God made flesh. In the scriptures, we hear the revelation of his love. You did not choose me, I chose you. The Father himself loves you. Everything I have is yours, Jesus tells us. I did not come to condemn the world. Your sins are forgiven. I am with you always, even until the end of time. These are radical truths. These are liberating truths. Jesus, he's for us. You know, the culture around us often leaves us with a sense of hopelessness, insinuating that God is non-existent or at best, distant. Earlier this year, one of our sisters was home visiting her family, and they had decided one night to go out to dinner. And after they were seated at their table, the waitress came over, and I suspect she was a little surprised to see a sister in full habit in her restaurant. To her credit, for most people, it can be a bit jarring. But when she came over, she looked at Sister Bethany and she said, "So what's with the dress?" And then she quickly caught herself and said, "Sorry, what's with the habit?" And so Sister replied that, you know, that she was a sister of life. And she said, "You know, we help women who are pregnant and tempted to abortion." And this waitress knelt down next to Sister and said to her, "Where were you when I needed you?" And Sister quickly shared with her that we have a ministry to those who are suffering after abortion. And so the woman again asked, "Who can I call to get help?" Sister Bethany gave her the number to our Hope and Healing ministry, encouraged her to call our sisters, which she did the next morning straight away. And after talking to our sisters for a while, she decided to go on a healing retreat that we were hosting near where she lived. You know, as Christians, Archbishop Fisher, you know, shared with us how we have a duty to care for the weak, to care for the most vulnerable, to care for those who are abandoned, right? This is so important, especially in the culture in which we live today. Now more than ever, we need Christians to step forward and courageously allow our faith in Jesus Christ to bear rich fruit and outreach to those who need it most. One of our guests at Sacred Heart Convent, Raquel, she was an incredible woman. She lived with us a few years ago, and she had told us when she moved in that even though she was choosing life for her child, she told us she would never, you know, tell another person what to do. She would justify that in some instances, it'd be okay to have an abortion. And that is until one day the Lord put her in an encounter with another woman that changed really both of their lives forever, truly transformed both of them. Raquel was on the way to a doctor's appointment, and she was in a lift in the hospital, and this other woman had gotten on with her, and after Raquel greeted her, this woman told her that she was pregnant. And so I want to share with you this encounter in Raquel's own words. She says, "I said, 'Congratulations, I'm pregnant too.' And she explained that she just couldn't do it right now. It wasn't the right time. And then Raquel felt her baby move, and she placed her hand on her belly, and Raquel said, 'Do you feel that?' And right at that moment, my baby kicked her. She said, 'Wow.' I said, 'Yeah, my baby, he's going to be an NFL football player. He's going to be strong, and he's going to be blessed.' And she said, 'Well, why is he going to be blessed?' And I said, 'Because he's here. Whether you laugh or you cry, if you're here, You're blessed. You're put here for a reason. And she said, I'm going to get an abortion. And I said, no, you're not. You don't even want to have an abortion. You're going to have a girl. I wanted a girl, but I'm having my boy, and that's okay. You have your girl, and dress her up in pink and put ponytails in her hair and call her Raquel. And by the way, my middle name, it's Jasmine. And if she asks you how she got her name, tell her you met a fabulous lady one day who was pregnant, and she told you that you were going to have a beautiful little girl. She laughed, and then we got off the lift together, and I walked her down to make an appointment with my obstetrician. Raquel goes on to say, I didn't see her again until 2 years later at the same hospital. She was pushing a stroller and ran up to me and hugged me. She had had twins, two girls. You know what she named them? Raquel and Jasmine. And she had them all dressed up in pink, just like I told her. She had made it. She said, I love you. You don't understand, Raquel. I love you. I love you. I love you. I'll never forget your name, your face, your smile. I love you. I'd do anything for you. And I said, I love you too. I understand. I've experienced it. Do you know what enabled that young woman to a newfound freedom and hope, so much so that it allowed her to choose life for her twin daughters and really new life for herself? And I'm convinced it was Raquel's conviction to reach out to another, even by random chance in a lift. Friends, the world is dying for this witness of hope and love. Pope Francis has even implored this of us in his encyclical Evangelii Gaudium, The Joy of the Gospel. Our Holy Father says, each one of us must make present the fragrance of Christ's closeness and his personal gaze. The church will have to initiate everyone, priests, religious, and laity, he says, into this art of accompaniment, which teaches us to remove our sandals before the sacred ground of the other. The human heart so longs for someone in our midst who's another Christ in the flesh, who loves us with an authentic love, who truly gives us hope. I have a little video I want to share with you, our sisters put together, that I think really does illustrate just the beauty of life.
So now I hope some mics are going to go around the room. Is that right? For any questions, comments, objections, expressions of horror or delight.
Excellent. Just a question, Your Grace. I'm a nurse by trade, and in various lectures, when we've stumbled onto the topic of resuscitation, there's been a bit of a question as to when to and when not to resuscitate. Now, I know in palliation, it's advised that resuscitation doesn't go ahead because it's likely to cause more damage than good. I'm asking, is that consistent with church teaching? And on top of that, at what point in gestational age should we start resuscitation? The law says 20 weeks. In your opinion, is that consistent with the culture of life?
Okay. Why would you ever resuscitate someone that looks dead? The reason is because they're not dead. There's no point in resuscitating a corpse, let me assure you. You can't do it. It's failed. They're dead. They're irreversibly dead. But sometimes people look dead, or they look like they're dying, and you can get in there and do some things to actually save their life. I think our first instinct, like the Good Samaritan, should be and should continue to be in healthcare, our first instinct should be to get in there and save, if we can. But we know that sometimes, try as we might, you can't. If you've already tried resuscitating three or four times and the person's been had no blood flow, perhaps for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, even longer, the chances are going down, down, down that you can actually achieve anything. In the process too, you might be breaking ribs, you might be traumatizing the person. So your question has to be, at that point, do I have a good chance of actually succeeding in resuscitating? And in doing so, are they going to be better off, or am I actually, for instance, going to make a dying person just suffer more as they're dying? And those are the hard questions that come for people, particularly in intensive care units, particularly in palliative care units, particularly in nursing homes, where people are making decisions where they think it's not like if one of you keels over, we're going to move in fast and very quickly do all we can to resuscitate you. We know it's got a very good chance of working and that it's not going to do such harm to you that it's going to make your dying worse. But with people who are already very sick or very frail or in a great deal of pain, then we do have to ask, is this intervention going to be too burdensome for them or going to be futile? And those are judgments which I think we rightly make, and sometimes that means we decide, no, this person is not for resuscitation. We know they're going to be dead within the week anyway, whatever we do. We don't want to make that last week or day or hour they've got more miserable. We want to make it more comfortable. And so that person's not going to get that treatment. But there's a risk sometimes people get that label, don't resuscitate, because we've decided they're not worth it. We just wish they'd hurry up and die. We'll be relieved if they do. Well, then there's a real problem, I think. And there is a danger in our community that some people get classified as the better off dead people, people we're not going to even try with anymore. So, yes, sometimes we don't resuscitate for very good reasons. It's futile, it's too burdensome, it's going to make the dying worse. But sometimes we might be failing to for some bad reason.
I was just wondering about adoption. Why is that so uncommon in Australia?
The reason adoption doesn't happen in Australia is that babies aren't born anymore that aren't wanted. So basically, in this country, we've gone from a situation where in the past, many infertile couples could adopt because there were other couples or other women who gave their child life but knew they couldn't bring the child up themselves. So they said to another mother, to another couple, would you please take our child through the orphanage system? Well, in this country now what people do if they're not ready for a child is they just abort the child. And so there's no babies in orphanages anymore. There's no orphanages left anymore. That's the sad reality in Australia. I think many people think it'd be cruel to bring a child into this world and then adopt them out. It'd be better for the child if they were just killed, and better for me because I'm not going to spend the rest of my life wondering about that child, worrying about that child. But I think there might be some very good reasons to consider adoption, and here's someone that knows more about that than I do.
I'm not sure about that, but just in our experience, as Sisters of Life, we serve in New York alone about 1,000 women every year who are pregnant and potentially vulnerable. And of those 1,000 women, we might see 2 or 3 who would choose to place their child for adoption. There was actually a study in the States several years ago asking this very question. And what the study concluded is that women who are in crises, women who are tempted to abortion, perceive that choosing to place their child for adoption is a worse option than actually having an abortion. They perceive there's this psychological sense of, I'm abandoning my child. I'm not good enough to be a mom, so I have to give away is the word they'll use, their child. And so they see that as a worse option than actually terminating the pregnancy completely. It's fascinating. And it's so interesting because you would think that adoption is a loving choice, and it is a loving choice, but it actually, in our experience, really takes a heroic woman who is in that situation to really have the maturity to choose adoption. And it's something, you know, that we must pray for, that they are able to see, you know, that first of all, that every life is sacred and, you know, that there are possibilities. So.
Your Grace, I enjoyed your presentation, but I kind of got stuck on something.
Sure.
I was just wanting to query your placement or your inclusion of Ritalin in your presentation and what the purpose of that was.
Of Ritalin?
Yes, yep. Not of Ritalin, but of the yep. inclusion in this presentation.
We now use pharmacology to address almost everything in human experience. So if your husband dies, the traditional way of helping the widow was to surround her with an extended family, with other women who would scream and mourn with her, with people that would pat her and love her and carry her through. Now what we do is we sedate her. Traditionally, when we had elderly people who were confused and were inclined to escape and end up wandering the streets and not knowing who they were or where they were, well, what we did was we made sure, again, there was an extended family around them, and we tried to entertain them and to one way or another keep them occupied and make sure someone's watching the door that grandma doesn't escape. Now what we tend to do is drug her in an institution so she can't actually get out of bed or out of her chair. Traditionally, when children were difficult behaviourally, we had various interventions to try to assist them to be better behaved and to be happy. And now very often our first way of dealing with that is to move in with a drug. Now, of course, in all those situations, a woman who's depressed after grieving the loss of her husband, sedation, antidepressants might be exactly right for her. That might be exactly what she needs to get over a hump so she can deal with the issue, so that she can possibly be drug-free. She might even have to be on drugs forever, depending on her situation. The old person might need some kind of drug to calm them down so they're not permanently agitated and frightened and angry and hurting themselves or hurting each other. And the kid might be exactly right for them to have certain drugs that will help them to normalise a chemical imbalance and for their behaviour to be able to fit in better with other kids and be happier in themselves. So I'm not saying no to any of this pharmacology. It can be really good for people. But I do think we have to question that the whole approach to every problem in life is to come in with a drug, an operation, a procedure, often an expensive procedure. To take the biggest one of all, in the 1960s, humanity was persuaded that half of humanity, the women, should take a drug every day of their adult life, at least for the rest of their fertile life, and called the pill. Let's leave aside for a moment any issues about the morality or not of contraception. The whole notion that the way you approach your body and its fertility is just drug it. Just get in there with chemicals quick. Rather than asking, well, what's the body for? What's the sexuality for? Will this be good for me? Will it have side effects? What does it do to me emotionally, psychologically? What does it do to the attitudes of men towards me and so on? No, just get in there with the drug. I think back then in the 60s, I think right now in 2015, with all these drugs, we should ask, yes, they've got good uses one way or another, but are there other ways that we could perhaps be managing the situation better or as well?
And this will be our last question.
Thank you. I've got a few years on me and I've been battling against abortion and euthanasia for most of my life. I have two adopted sons, by the way, so I'm probably one of the last people around that was able to adopt children. I come from Victoria, and my wife's a nurse. The abortion laws are so bad there that it's now illegal for her not to participate in abortion. It's illegal for doctors not to do it. They can be sacked. So my question is, are we losing the battle?
I think at every time in Christian history, it's been a few steps forward and a few steps back. And often we've felt it's a losing battle. We're hitting our heads against the wall. And yet at that very moment, sometimes some new thing springs up, some new hope, just when we thought it was all doomed, it was at its worst. And so you're right. What's happened in Victoria? What's happened in Tasmania? Where now health professionals are told, you either assist in abortion or refer to someone who will, which is still assisting in abortion, or you're out of this profession. It's a disgraceful imposition on people's consciences, on people's freedom to be health professionals. And now they've added to that that no one's allowed to demonstrate against abortion or even pray quietly and peaceably against abortion anywhere near an abortion clinic. In a society that prides itself on freedom of expression and freedom to demonstrate and so on. There are very powerful ideological forces and interests in our world at the moment that are anti-life and anti even the freedom to have a different opinion. But at the same time, I remember 15 years ago when we had euthanasia briefly in the Northern Territory and then we took it away, people said, it's inevitable. Euthanasia is coming for sure. There's this country's done it and that country's done it. Australia will have euthanasia all across Australia by the year 2000. And here we are in 2015 and we don't have it anywhere. So people might have lost hope, but it was worth you and your generation battling on. Because, you know, you win some, you lose some. But things could be worse. In fact, I know the world would be much worse if people of passion like you weren't constantly trying to celebrate and protect human life. And I have great confidence that I look around the young people we've got here, 3,500 of them, with such golden hearts and idealism for our world, wanting to make our world a better place for people by God's grace, that they'll do great things for the cause of human life in the years ahead too.
That was Archbishop Anthony Fisher and Sister Miriam Caritas, SV, with Choosing Life. This talk is from the Australian Catholic Youth Festival 2015 and was recorded as a collaboration between XT3 and Cradio. And for more from the Australian Catholic Youth Festival, and for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.